Welcome to Bubbles and Benevolence, the podcast where we pop the bubbles to success and dive deep into the benevolent hearts of those who have achieved it. In this podcast, we'll sit down with successful business leaders, philanthropists, nonprofit workers, and more to discuss their journeys, the lessons they've learned along the way, and how they're using their success to make a positive impact on the world. So grab a glass of bubbles and join us as we explore the intersection of business and benevolence and discover what it truly means to be successful. Get ready for an exhilarating episode filled with boundless energy and captivating tales as we welcome the extraordinary Lauralee Cunningham to the show. Lauralee is a true force of nature, embodying the rare combination of a creative spirit and an analytical mind. Her life's journey has taken her on an awe-inspiring adventure, spanning diverse fields such as accounting, fashion design, physiotherapy, and even horse breeding. In today's riveting conversation, we delve into the remarkable experiences that have shaped Lauralee's path, including the formidable challenges she has recently faced. Prepare to be inspired as she generously imparts her invaluable wisdom on finding mentors and navigating the intricacies of entrepreneurship. But that's not all. We'll also dive into Lauralee's deep passion for horses, her extraordinary efforts in fundraising to rehome X-race horses, to fight breast cancer with research funding, and support families impacted by domestic violence with Women's Legal Service Queensland. And just when you think this conversation couldn't get any more exciting, we have an exclusive and electrifying announcement waiting for you at the very end. So saddle up, hold tight, and join us for this enthralling chat between Lauralee and Marisa. You won't want to miss a single moment of this captivating episode.
Well, I'm so excited today to have one of the most buoyant and colourful people in the whole of Brisbane, or maybe the world, with us today, the quintessentially gorgeous Lauralee Cunningham. Lauralee, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you, Marisa. That's a beautiful, beautiful entree. Not sure if I live up to it, but anyway, thank you.
Well, your jacket does today, at the very least. I didn't expect you to come in black or white.
One day I'll shock you and wear beige.
Oh, no, I do not believe that will ever happen. But, Lauralee, it is truly such a pleasure to have you. And we always start our podcasts by asking you to talk about your favourite bubbles and perhaps why it's become your favourite. So thrill us with what your favourite bubbles is and why.
So my favourite bubbles is Louis Rodera, and I say the 242, and I only say that because Tony Johns told me to say that, and he's you know, the absolute, I think, the king of bubbles. If Bernadette Shea is a queen, he's the king. True. And he, I have always loved Verve, but, you know, and still love Verve, but just through meeting Tony and a group of friends, and we always drink champagne when we're together, I love that I'm becoming educated by a friend of mine over a beautiful glass of bubbles. So that's just a lovely thing. And really, Marisa, my palate is not that sophisticated. I did a course with Bernadette O'Shea and I think I failed terribly and I was in awe of her. But really, that's, you know, I drink it and I love it, and I'm learning more and more as I go along. See, you never stop learning about bubbles, darling, so it's a wonderful thing.
And I think, Lauralee, thinking about the last few years, particularly in your and my life, it is, we are definitely the people that embody the drinking of champagne when we're happy or sad or anything in between, because it seems to be that ultimate pick-me-up and celebratory drink, but also something you can actually drink when you are a bit down. So, and tell me about 242. I haven't heard of the Louis Rodera
242. Well, there's a 242 and a 243. And from what I've learnt from Tony, the 242 is just has different tones to it, if that's the right word, whatever. But, you know, it. All I know is when I drink it, the bubbles dance in my tongue, and it just is very easy, beautiful, easy champagne to drink. 243 is probably not that much different, but anyway.
Just a digit apart,
really. He said
the
242, so I'm saying the 242.
And for those of you that don't know, Tony and Fran Johns are the wonderful developers and owners of the Emporium Hotel in Brisbane, which is one of the most beautiful hotels in town, and it's sophisticated in every way, isn't it, Lauralee?
Oh,
from design to the restaurants to the events that we've held there, I think, individually as well. And so he should know what he's talking
Absolutely.
About.
Absolutely. And they're amazing people, because they have, you know, the artistic design that they put into the original hotel, the original Emporium, and then this one is quite amazing. And they're just such a great team, Fran and Tony. So they work so well together and they have different and complementary skills. And, yeah, it's wonderful. It's wonderful getting to know them better and spending time. I've known them for many years, but particularly the last couple of years. So, yes, Tony's my educator in bubbles.
We all need an educator. I actually want to ask one question before we leave the drinks issue, because I think I said in my first episode of the podcast, I didn't discover champagne till I was in my 40s. And growing up in an Italian family that kind of prioritised Asti, Riccadonna and Spumanti and Prosecco. Do you remember having your first glass of champagne?
I do, and I don't know. I think it probably was around then. I really had, as I said, not having, you know, hugely sophisticated palate, but in saying that, I still know what I like. I remember my brother when I was quite young, maybe about 19, and he's a few years older, and he and his wife were very much into good wines. And I know that he conned me into being, I was going to say an escort, that sounds terrible, not an escort.
I know you've had a very varied career. I didn't have that one on my list.
Take the escort bit, mate. They had some tasting, and I was like Miss BYO Maroomba. Now, Maroomba was some, I think it was probably a dreadful, I shouldn't, I hope you know, it's not still around, the makers aren't still around, but I remember it was a very inexpensive wine to drink. So I sort of thought, oh, I'll get onto this. And then, you know, I used to drink Shinzano, dreadful things. And really, I then stopped drinking anything but white wine. And then that led me into drinking, it wasn't champagne, it was sparkling wine, which is pretty dreadful because it was very sweet. Mm. And so I stopped drinking that, and it wasn't until I probably, came to a time in my life where I could afford to buy good champagne that I did. And I actually can't remember the first glass, but I would have been, I think, probably in my 40s, and I remember thinking, this is so beautiful. And, loving it ever since. But strangely, we can talk about this later once we talk about my health journey, but I have loved it more since I've had breast cancer and my taste buds changed. And so silver lining, lovely silver lining of
that. We talked about a couple of silver linings, yes, which we will talk about later. Yeah. Well, let's cheers, Louis Rotorua, and yes, thank you for sharing with us the story of your journey with Ella. And cheers to a wonderful podcast.
Wonderful. Cheers. Thanks, Marissa. Mm.
Tell me about when we first met.
Marissa, I remember knowing of you and reading about you and wanting to get to know you. And we met at a mutual friend's house. And you, what I was struck by when I met you was your beautiful and warm, friendly nature. And I'm always drawn to warm, friendly people. Sometimes if they're not warm and friendly, it's a little bit of a, you know, provides a challenge. So I might chase those people just to get them, you know, get them right into my sort of area of let's have a good chat. But you were amazingly warm and beautiful. And I remember we spoke, I was really in awe of what you were doing with Hanworth House. It was after the Hanworth House burnt down, but prior to you getting breast cancer.
Oh, okay. So that was probably about eight years ago maybe?
Yeah. And I was just so delighted to finally meet you because you're always this person who I was in awe of for your beautiful spirit, the way that you got things done. And, you know, and I, at that time I knew you did wonderful events, and I was always, again, very respectful and in awe of people who did things and made things happen, and especially in the philanthropic area. So I was very, very happy that day to have you on the veranda to myself for, I think we spoke for about 20 minutes.
Oh, that wouldn't be unlike us, would it? Talking for 20 minutes. I probably had a couple of champagnes by then.
That's right. I think you and I, you know, had about three breaths because we had a lot to exchange. But I knew from that time that I met you, Marissa, that you would be in my life.
Oh, and we have been in each other's life ever since. So I'm very grateful, conversely. And we've had some wonderful adventures together. So I'd love to explore some of those today. But thank you for those lovely words. I really appreciate them, and definitely appreciate you being a part of my orbit these days. But one thing I don't know about you is where you grew up, you know, how you grew up, what you did at school, what did you do afterwards? Because I think it's been, I would assume, a very varied trajectory to where you are today. So yeah. I'd love you to tell me a bit about that.
Well, I will, Marissa. It's quite funny that we've known each other and we really have never spoken about this. So I grew up in Camp Hill. I was actually born at the Red Brick Hotel down at South Brisbane. My father was a publican and I was the youngest of five. And my father died when I was 18 months old and had been ill for some time with a brain tumour. And my mum was managing the pub and managing five children, and he was very ill and passed away. So my mother then moved to Camp Hill and bought a house there and really didn't have any money because in those days, the death duties had taken away anything she had. So mum was, you know, really struggling. She was a young mother of, you know, in the late 30s with five children. So we moved to Camp Hill. She sent the boys, my older brothers, to Villanova, and she met their school teacher, Peter Rowley, and she then married Peter Rowley about 18 months later. So wow. It was scandalous.
Was there scandal at the school?
Scandalous. Because he was a bachelor. He'd never been married. He was at their teachers too, so they had to keep it very quiet. You know, the boys would, I remember one time Michael telling me that he got into trouble from him at school for not, because he forgot his homework, but Dad had been at our place the night before and saw it, but he had to treat Michael as well. Michael never forgave him
didn't you see it last night when you were
well,
at
Well,
they
were sworn to secrecy. Anyway, when the truth came out that the widow of five, and because she also was a publican's wife, it was all a bit scandalous. Anyway, so, they got married. And being the youngest of five, my older four siblings all left home quite early. One went to the Navy, one went to Melbourne. Diane got married, had a baby, and my other brother moved somewhere else. And they all left within a period of 12 months. So I really grew up as an only child. I had four siblings, but, you know, my years at primary school, then leading into high school, I was really an only child. And I adored my stepdad. He was the most beautiful man. So I had a lovely life with my mum supporting me senseless and him supporting me. He used to take me to, you know, great adventures, and he was a lovely man. So I went to school at Loretto, Convent at Cooperoo, and then I finished year 12 and I decided bizarrely to study accounting. And to this day, I have no idea why the universe led me there. Well, look, to be honest, I did start off studying journalism because I thought that might be some way to lead me into public relations or something interesting, and the course just all fell apart. So I decided that I would study accounting. So I did a Bachelor of Commerce, hated every second of it, but it's probably one of the best things I've ever done. The first term of when I was at university, I met my husband, Gary. So we start dating then. So I was very young, I was 17.
Wow.
And I met him, and so I graduated from university and worked as an accountant for 10 years. Gary and I got married and started having babies and kept working there. And then he got a job in Melbourne. So I went down to Melbourne. I decided I was having a little break from accounting. And I started a fashion label just because I was fiddling around, made myself something, painted it. In those days it was like, you know, all the hand painting and embellishment. Did that, popped the outfit on, went into Melbourne shopping. This lady said to me, oh, where'd you get that amazing outfit from? And I said, I made myself. She said, well, can you provide the store? I said, of course I can. At that stage, I really knew no one in Melbourne, so I still to this day don't know how I made that happen, but I did. So that was the start of my fashion label called Bows and Hearts Designs. When we moved back to Brisbane a few years later, I opened a store at Rosalie. Again, well, see, there we go. All comes around. That was the development that Tony Johns did down at Rosalie. So I opened a store down there, and then we moved to Nashville, Tennessee, to start a business over there. So I closed the store, moved to Nashville, So my accounting hat was back on over there. So it was a very complex, you know, being in the healthcare system over there with all the different healthcare companies. So my accounting hat was back on, and I loved that experience over there. Country music, amazingly beautiful, warm people, and just it was such a challenging but incredibly rewarding time. So we did that for years, and then I came back and opened up Happiness Place. So I wanted to go back to the other side of my brain again. So I flipped from, you know, accounting to fashion, then accounting again, and then back to something beautiful and creative. And so that was all around beautiful interiors, and I did that with my daughter Stephanie, who'd been living in the UK. So she sort of brought all her ideas from the UK, mine from the US, and we just created this beautiful place called Happiness Place.
It was a beautiful place. I remember I must have gone there before I met you officially. Yeah. The beautiful purple teapot and cups at Hanworth come from my friend Fleur, who bought them after seeing the Happiness Place. But I've got quite a lot of lovely things from that store. But I'm thinking, how did you flick that mind from accounting to fashion design? I mean, we all have this stereotypical view of an accountant, right? You know, the person that would have walked in here wearing beige this morning would have been accountant Loralee. But it really is so diverse. I mean, were you artistic as a child?
No, not at all. Not at all. My extent of being artistic was to, you know, decorate my bedroom. I remember I had a purple bedspread with orange embroidery through it.
They were my favourite two colours too as a child, purple and orange. And we are so in these days.
I know. But I never thought of myself as artistic. I always thought that I wanted to please my parents, and I wanted to go to university, and I wanted to get a degree. So I guess doing that first year of journalism, which didn't work out, was, again, it was me flipping. It was going from a creative degree to something like accounting, which is, you know, so on the other end of the spectrum. So my whole life I flipped between the two. And I do one for a while, and then I flip to the other, and then, you know, it goes back. But now, you know, I look back over all of those times, and when I was involved in a creative part of my life, the accounting and the commerce background that I had helped so much. And, you know, I talk to, QUT fashion students now and say to them, you know, one of the most important things you can do is school yourself in business, because so many creative people fail because they're so incredibly talented, but they forget that they're running a business too, and their creative mind doesn't allow them to focus on those sort of issues. So I'm very fortunate. I'm a left brain, right brain flipper.
That's amazing. I just never knew that there was so much happening in your life between the two universes.
Yeah.
So I just desperately want to hear more. One thing before I leave this growing up and the world of business, you said you went to Nashville, but there must have been a motivating force to go to Nashville. I mean, it was a very big decision and a very big interest again.
That was probably, one time in my life that I left it all in my – it was something my husband Gary wanted to do, and he had been thinking about it for a long time, and we had come across a couple when we lived in Melbourne, and his wife was an Australian physiotherapist and he was American, and he wanted to set up – they went back to Chicago and he wanted to set up a business over there in Australian-style physiotherapy. So Gary went over there and set it all up for him. And after he did that, Gary said to me, look, I really think that we could do this in partnership with them, but expand it. So we went to Nashville, Tennessee, and mainly because of Tracy Hawkins, who you would know, who was an amazing Olympian swimmer. So she came from Nashville. So they joined the business. So we changed our mind from setting up in Chicago to setting up in Nashville. And I'm forever grateful for that decision, because I always have, always will love country music. So I was in heaven going to Nashville. And in those days, it was 1996, it was a very big, a small big country town, if that makes any sense. It was similar to Brisbane in size, but it felt like it was about 20 years behind Brisbane. In, you know, there was no, all the restaurants were chain restaurants. There was no, excuse me, no decent coffee. The bread was sweet and horrible. Basically everything was just sort of very small town, but the music was everything. The music just made me, you know, I didn't really care if I was drinking terrible coffee and eating terrible bread, if I had music. And music has always been very important in my life. And it was just incredible over there, because you'd go to the littlest bars and there'd be someone amazing playing there, or there'd be someone you've never heard of before who was completely amazing, and you couldn't understand why they weren't some, you know, Garth Brooks or some amazing star. So we built the business over there over a period of about 20, 25 years, and we lived there. We, you know, we then came back to Brisbane for the kids to be in school, and we went back and forth. Gary and I travelled back and forth, and it was just incredible. They're just such warm, beautiful people over there. So we took all Australians over there to start the business, and what we knew was that Australian physiotherapists were trained better and did a better job of rehabilitating people than what the US-trained physiotherapists were. Back then, the US therapists did a lot of exercise prescriptions, so a lot of their clinics looked like gyms. There was lots of bikes, lots of things, and they weren't really trained in manual techniques. So we took the Australians over there, set up these, you know, outpatient physiotherapy clinics with Australians who were so well trained, and we said to the doctors, and it was all the patients had to come through doctor medical referral. There was no direct access. So we went to the doctors and said, look, we would like you to send us your hardest patients, your most difficult patients, and we will get them better for you. And we did. So that's how we started. And by the time we sold the business, we had hundreds and hundreds of clinics in 10 different states. And it was quite a challenge getting the message through without storming and saying we are better than you. But, you know, the Southern American people are so embracing. There is no tall poppy syndrome at all. They are beautiful people, and they wanted us to achieve and to, you know, to be successful over there. And so they were very supportive. And, yeah, so we very proud of what we did over there, because we did great things. We prevented many, many people from surgeries, and so it's still operating over there, and we're very proud of it.
Amazing. So how long did you spend in the States?
So we were there, we were there for 5 years permanently, and then we came back with the children, and Gary and I commuted. So one of us would go over there, one would stay in Brisbane with the kids, the other one would go to Nashville to work, and then we'd come home, see each other for a week, and then swap back over. That went on for quite a few years. And then when the older three children finished school, I forgot to mention, the first time we came back, I found out I was pregnant at 42. So that was sort of going to halt the travelling back and forth a bit.
That was the consequence of Gary being away for so long. It was you being away for so long and having to really catch up when you came back, right?
I always say to Xavier's mortification that he was my country music love child. And when I say love, I go love, and he hates that.
Sorry, Zave. Sorry, not sorry.
Can you imagine? He's now 22, just dying at the thought. Anyway, and my 16-year-old daughter also died at the thought that mum and dad were still doing it. And
so 42. And so, you know, how did you react to that? I mean,
I was just happy. Look, to be honest, we'd always wanted to have another baby, but we were so busy in Nashville building this business that I knew I couldn't take any time off work. So I had said to Gary when we were coming back, I said, you know, darling, you know, if you want to have that other baby, and he said, well, yeah, great. And I said, well, seeing we're going back to, you know, Brisbane next year. That's probably going to be a good time, but I said, you know, I'm getting to that age where things are starting to get a little bit difficult. And, yeah, and it just happened. It was almost like we manifested it. We, you know, decided to come back to Brisbane now. And I got back here and, no, I found out just before we moved back. And so I had to come back and tell all my friends and everyone, and they were like, are you serious? So it was a planned, it wasn't a shock, but it was always one of those things. If it happened, it happened. If it didn't, it didn't. But yeah, then we've got this, you know, beautiful, beautiful young man now who, you know, I loved being part of his life, going back to school, because he started school the year after my youngest of the other three had finished. Yes. So I'm starting off in grade one with a grade oneer when all my friends are out of, you know, all their kids have graduated. So it was, but it's been the most amazing experience. I've made beautiful friends through him, and it certainly does. It does keep you young.
How incredible. In terms of, you had a comment a little while ago about, I just flick between, you know, accounting and then creative and accounting. One thing you haven't flicked between is your husband's.
That's right.
So it's very lovely to see that Gary has been the stable influence in your life, despite your career taking many directions. But yes. Gary seems to be always this incredibly supportive rock.
He is. He's amazing. He's so calm. He and I are so different. You couldn't find two people who are more different. But it works because of that, I think. And he is calm. Nothing phases Gary. You can be faced with the biggest issue to deal with, and he's calm. Unless it includes children, then that rattles him more than anything. But anything on a business level, anything on, you know, health levels, any problem you may have, Gary is just very gentle, calming influence in my life, and it allows me to do everything I do, I think.
Well, it's lovely to see you together. I'm glad that he had a little spot in our little podcast discussion as well, because I think that's incredibly important.
Yeah.
You've been very interested in startups. Obviously, your American one was, Happiness Place was. Tell me what you think about, I think your personality is one that lends itself to something new and exciting. You see the challenge and the opportunity in something that's new. But I know a lot of the people that listen to the podcast are starting out in their careers and have a great idea. What do you think are perhaps the two biggest challenges to starting out a new business? I think you mentioned one of them before about making sure that if it is something creative that you have a bit of a sound financial nous about it. So that's possibly one of the things. What other things do you think people should think about before they embark on something new?
I think one of the things that people need to do and understand before they start their startup is do a lot of research first and ask a lot of questions. You may get doors slammed in your face from people who won't share the knowledge, but there are so many incredible people in this world who want to help you and who want to mentor you and who want to share their invaluable experiences. And learning about what you are wanting to start up, and so it may be an idea that someone else has never tried. Even if that is the case, there will be people who've done something similar in those, you know, in that sort of area that you are thinking of starting out in. So I would say, you know, it's just so important to talk to people and find just one mentor too, who will keep you going after you start the business, someone you can phone and just ask a quick question of. I just think that's so important. And I think the second thing that is really important too is to, going back to what I said before, is understand how a cash flow works and understand how your revenue cycles work. And it's something that you should know once you've been in your business for, you know, 12 months, 2 years. You should have a really good grasp on, you could take a snapshot of your business and you know exactly where it is and what's happening with it, and you know if there's a problem with it, whether your revenues are, you know, are decreasing in line with your expenses or whatever is happening there. But you really do need to have someone to help you with that. So if you don't have that skill, choose someone who can work with you on that, or again, educate yourself so that you know. And that, for me, I feel is the greatest gift that I had, was that anything we did, I had that solid financial accounting base that gave me the confidence and the knowledge, which whatever business we started, I could find myself with my nose in the books, and I knew what I could understand what was going on.
And you stress the importance of a mentor. Can you articulate, or looking back at what you've established in terms of a mentor relationship, what is the number one characteristic that you think is the most important characteristic of someone looking for a mentor? If I'm going to start a business and I'm looking for someone to mentor me in some way, what do you think the number one thing is that I should be looking for in that person?
I think you should look for someone who communicates well with you, that you can communicate directly with that person. They can communicate with you, meaning that they're honest with you, that they're not going to pretty up a situation to make you feel good about things, that they will be honest with you when you say, what do you think about this? So someone you can freely and honestly communicate with, I think, is the most important, absolutely the most important thing.
And you probably, conversely, been asked to be a mentor, right?
Yes, yes. Yeah.
And as a mentor, what do you think is the number two things that you should be able to give back before you decide to actually take someone on? What process do you go through to determine if you're a suitable mentor for someone who, because you must get asked to be a mentor for many people and you can't be everything to everyone, right? So what kind of litmus test would you use to determine someone who you think you'd be a good fit for as a mentor?
Well, I always say, I always ask these individuals what support they're looking for, and I talk about what experience they've had first, so I get to know them a little bit, find out what support they need. And the first thing I do as a mentor is tell them what my strengths are and what my weaknesses are. So if my weaknesses are something that they're going to rely on, that they need in that business, I would just say, I'm not the right person for you. But I think I quite often then try and suggest someone else, usually my husband.
Because we're having a chalk and cheese relationship, isn't it?
That's right. I direct them to him. But yeah, there's been businesses that we have invested in, and Gary is a very strong mentor for a lot of startups. And there are things that, you know, he sometimes refers to me, but I will, because he has such a strong base on so many different areas, he is a very, very good mentor. But there are things in creative lines for, you know, where we know in, say, in, you know, we've in the arts and in fashion and different areas like that, where Gary will pass most of it over to me and say, you need to speak to Laura Lee about this area. I have no idea. And so he passes that over, and I do the same thing with him. So sometimes we act as joint mentors, which works really well, depending on what the business is. Sometimes I just know exactly it's his forte, and sometimes he knows it's my forte.
I think that's a great relationship, partnership in life and partnership in business, which is sometimes challenging, I would think.
Absolutely.
In many respects as well. But I want to then go and talk to you about, it sounds to me that you're often an accidental participant in business. It just comes, or your whim comes your way and you decide to take it, which is very ambitious and throwing caution to the wind a lot of the time, with a general feeling about risk management. But I want to, perhaps just after we take a little break, talk about how you came and to indulge your love of horses, perhaps. And
sure.
Then I will definitely want to participate in a lovely discussion around philanthropy.
Beautiful.
What an incredible chat so far. Now, while we take a quick break, I want you to imagine this. You're standing in front of your closet. It's overflowing with stunning designer clothing. What if those beautiful pieces could do more than just take up space? Now is the time to make a positive impact while cleaning out your closets and turn your unworn designer pieces into a powerful force for good. Simply spring clean early and donate your items to Labels on the Lawn coming this October, the premier pre-loved fashion event of the year, with all proceeds benefiting Women's Legal Service Queensland and their mission to provide free legal support to women impacted by domestic violence. You can drop your designer clothing to any of our retail partners, Jolie Boutique in Ascot, SFH Designs in New Farm, the Love Me Again Markets at Stafford in Milton, Styling Station in Milton, and of course, Hanworth House in East Brisbane. The Hanworth House team will be at the Love Me Again Markets at Milton on Sunday, June 18th from 8 a.m. to 12 p.m. with a pop-up boutique, and will be accepting designer clothing donations during that time. So make some room in your closet and come and visit us. Check out the episode description for more details about our drop-off partners. Now let's get back to this enthralling chat with Marisa and Laurelly.
So I want to hear about how you stumbled into horses.
Well, we literally did. We stumbled into Magic Millions in 2017, my husband, my son and myself, and we have a place at the Gold Coast, and I knew that Gary loved racing. And he had, I remember when we first met all those years ago, speaking about racing, and over the time we probably had been to the races, I don't know, count less than 10 times, but always loved it. But it really was never a part of our life because we were busy. We were busy building businesses, having children, and we were overseas a lot. So horses just weren't really anything that was sort of a big part of our lives until this day. And I said to him, darling, the auctions for Magic Millions are on, and it's just down the road, let's go. And he said, oh, okay. But this wasn't the first time I said this. He had said no, and a few times I said to him, look, if you don't want to buy a racehorse, we don't have to, but I thought you did. Later on I found out that it was because he knew when we bought one it would lead to 100 very quickly, and I thought it was going to be one. So all my encouragement was I don't know if I would have been that encouraging knowing it would be so many. But looking back now, it's the best thing we ever did, though. We stumbled into the sales, looked around. I thought there'd be a few horses there. There's just thousands. And so we marched up to the information booth and I said to the girl, excuse me, we would like to buy a horse, but we don't really know how to. She said, right, we'll get someone. And out walked beautiful Clint Donovan, who's now become a great friend of ours, and he's a wonderful auctioneer at the Gold Coast. He came out and sat down and said, I'll tell you how to buy a horse. You need to identify a trainer. We need this, we need that. What sort of horse? And all of a sudden Gary started speaking with his horsey lingo. And I thought, how did you learn this horsey lingo? And he wanted to stay, he wanted this, he wanted that. Anyway, I just sat there in quite a bemused state. Anyway, we missed out on the first couple of horses, and on the last day we bought this beautiful filly who we named Light of the Room, or Gary named, which is very sweet of him. He named it after me, so that was a very lovely, lovely thing to do. So he named
it. Is that
what
Laurelly means?
No, he just called it Light of the Room because he thinks I light up the room.
Light up the room. I thought perhaps Laurelly meant light up the room, which you do every time you walk into the room. So
no, Laurelly is actually a very nasty mermaid on the Rhine River. So a little bit different. So he said to me, okay, and again, not realising that we were going to buy a lot of horses going forward. So he said to me, look, I'll name the horse and you design the silks. I thought that I could, that was just the silks for Light Up the Room, and that I could, if we did buy other horses, that I could do different silks every time. So I just did it very quickly. And then when we bought the second horse about 2 weeks later, I said, oh, goody, now I'll just get my little pencils out and I'll design another little set of silks. And he said, no, Laurelly, in his very direct way, he said, no, those silks are going to be for all of our horses. And I said, that can't be. I said, that cannot be. I didn't put enough effort into those, and I don't really like them anyway.
That was my trial.
So we bought about 20 horses and they wore those silks. And then a couple of years later, my son Mitchell, who was a Cathay pilot and was wanting to be at home more with his little family. So Gary then decided, being the business brain that he is and knowing that racing is a fun thing to do, but Gary wanted to make a business out of it. So Gary decided we should start breeding. So he said to Mitchell, why don't you stop flying and come home and start our breeding company, which he did. So I said to Mitchell, first thing I said to Mitchell is, you can change those silks. Even I don't like them. And he said, right. So we now have beautiful blue and gold silks. So it's been the most amazing thing for our family. It's after selling our business in the US, I was a bit concerned about what Gary would do. I knew I was fine. I had other interests in other businesses and I knew I would be fine. But I was very concerned for him. It's been the most magnificent thing for our family. He works every day with his two sons. So Mitchell runs a breeding company. Xavier worked at our breeding farm down the Hunter Valley for 18 months and he's just back home now finishing his law degree. He will go on to work. He's got a dual degree, business and law. But he will work in the racing or breeding industry, probably go overseas for the next couple of years and work all around the world. But it gives Gary the opportunity to work with two of his boys and our other two children are very much involved too on you know, different levels. So it's just wonderful. And we've met the most magnificent people in racing. People come from all walks of life and that's what I love. And it's... Most, I mean, you know, they're just beautiful people who are very passionate about their horses and they're just interesting people and, you know, we're doing interesting things and at our stage in life it's just wonderful to be able to work with your children and work towards something that we hope will be a multi-generational business for our family.
But, Lauralee, I'm perplexed. So you walked into this sale yard and said, we want to buy a horse, and thank goodness Gary knew the lingo. Did you just go and choose the most fabulous-looking horse you could? I mean, or are you kind of giving us the kind of very PR version of what happened that day? Because of all these horses to choose from, I mean, I'm guessing there has to be a bit of a science as to which one you might invest in.
There's an amazing amount of science, but the science isn't good enough to work out who's going to win a race every time. Otherwise, it'd be, you know, no wagering. Anyway, but what Gary did was he wanted a stayer because Australia loves sprinters, whereas horses in overseas and European countries, people over there love stayers. So stayer is, you know, someone who runs more than, you know, 2 miles. Melbourne Cup is a staying race, which is why most horses come in from overseas for the Melbourne Cup because there's not so many stayers in Australia. So Gary knew he wanted a stayer. He loves certain horses that he just knew about. As I said, on that day, he blew me away with what he actually knew. So we were given a short list of six. So he gave the trainer that was nominated by Clint, who had his stockbroker agent there, and he said, these people want a horse that is, we didn't care whether it was a colt or a filly. So Gary gave him the list of who he wanted to stay, a few other sort of specifications. So we got a short list of six. So we went around and had a look at the six and I thought they were all beautiful. I think every horse is beautiful, but some are more beautiful than the other and others. But Mitch and I loved and light up the room was the last horse that we saw and she was a filly. And she was just, and she is beautiful. They named her Megan Gale in the stables because she was very tall, statuesque and beautiful. And she has since had two babies and is pregnant with a third and the babies are just stunning. So she was a very beautiful horse to look at. But because I love I look in the horse's eyes. So when you see the overall picture of the horse, you can see that some just have a beautiful, you know, Mitchell's educated me on a lot of things and what to look for. But honestly, on that day back in 2017, I was just loving them all. And I think it was the universe working for us to choose to get at auction because it's very competitive to buy these horses a lot of the time. And I think it was the universe directing us to her because she was a successful racehorse on the track and she's now we sold her first colt at Magic Mini's this year. So we're now selling selling horses as much as buying them. So that first day, I will always remember it being such a magical day of us going in there, not really knowing, Gary using the bit of education he had, and us coming up with this beautiful horse who is now living on our farm in the Hunter Valley, breeding for us. So it's beautiful.
It's amazing the way you and I have these lovely conversations about the universe directing us to do things. Mm. And I think that's something in life that you can't put a price on, isn't it?
Oh,
but not only are you buying and breeding, and you're also really concerned about what happens to the horses next.
Absolutely.
So tell us about Well Groomed.
Yes. So I formed back in 2021, I formed a group called Well Groomed Racing, which is a group of women who I knew were passionate about the horses. And there'd been that, you know, dreadful ABC report on what happened to a lot of horses post-racing. And I knew that that wasn't the case with the huge majority of ex-race horses. I knew firsthand that a lot of the horses went on to become show jumpers and equestrian, you know, they were involved in equestrian activities, and smaller ones could become polo horses, few of those because of their size. I also knew that of people who had farms just so that their horses could go to onto their farm after that. But at the same time, there were still unaccounted horses that we didn't know where they went to, what happened. So we decided that we would form this group to raise funds for rehoming of horses. And, of course, being thoroughbreds, they are born to race. They're bred to race. They're born to race. They love racing. So you have to retrain them after they leave the track to become a show jumper or, you know, an equine therapy animal. You really, they had this period of retraining. So our trainer's wife, Tony, Jane Gollan, had a foundation called Transitioning Thoroughbreds. So she would retrain these horses to go onto their afterlife and, I say, after racing life. So we raised money for her. So that's how it all started. And then, of course, I couldn't do anything last year because I was not well, but this year we're doing it again. And I went to an equine therapy farm last week who we're going to raise money for, and they help women suffering or who've come out of trauma, mainly domestic violence situations, also children at risk, children who have various problems, they won't go to school. They have these amazing courses out there. It's out in west of Brisbane. It's beautiful property. And they use these beautiful ex-race horses to help these women. And I spoke with the woman last week, and it just made me feel so proud of what these beautiful animals can do. And so, you know, they're beautiful, they're majestic, they're intelligent, they're intuitive. They can do so much to help people with mental health conditions or people who've suffered trauma. So there's so much they can do post-racing. It's just getting them, leading them into the right hands. And Racing Queensland now, we pay a percentage of our prize money to Racing Queensland. So they've got money there too, and they've been trying to work out how to get it through to the best avenues, which they're now doing, thank goodness. So a lot of the therapy farms are getting grants from Racing Queensland. And so it's a very good thing. So, you know, in some ways that dreadful, awful report has done a lot of good, because whilst it painted a picture that wasn't typical, it also made a lot of people sit up and think we need to do better here. And, so it's great, and I'm so happy that I can do that and make a difference. And so having a big fundraiser in September at Eagle Farm Racetrack, and want to raise a lot of money for the Equine Therapy Farm, and also one other organisation I'm raising money for, which is Kick Up, which is an amazing girl called Vicky Leonard. She has created this organisation to help people give a positive voice to racing. So when you go to the track and there's protesters outside screaming at you, telling you that you're a dreadful person because you're going to the track or you own a racehorse, she is educating people on the facts and figures so that we can argue the cause and say this is not the typical case. So Vicky's been amazing doing that. And the other lovely thing that happened to me last year through racing, apart from all the magnificent women I met, because I am in quite a lot of ladies only syndicates, Gay Waterhouse called me out of the blue one day. There was an article in a racing magazine about my fundraising. She called me. We've become great friends. She is one of the most wonderful women in racing. She does so much good. She's quirky. She's fun. She's successful. And she's just a great person to be around. She is so full of positive energy, Gay. So I feel very blessed I've got to know her too.
It's wonderful. This philanthropic heart of yours is something we're going to explore a little bit more in a second. But before we go there, there was a pretty special event last year that we're all kind of living vicariously through you as you were celebrating a wonderful horse win. Would you indulge us and tell us about A, being there, what it was like, and I don't even know how you would have felt when it all happened.
So we went to Royal Ascot last year for the first time. We had booked to go there in 2020 and that didn't happen due to COVID. So 2022, I just finished treatment and didn't know whether I'd be well enough to go, but I was, thank goodness. And we went over to England and went to Royal Ascot, and about 6 weeks we'd bought into this syndicate for this beautiful horse called State of Rest. And because we breed, we typically buy, if we do buy horses, we typically buy fillies. But we'd bought into this colt syndicate because he was just such a successful racehorse. And Mitchell said, we need to be involved with this horse. And it was with Newgate, who are a fantastic and amazing farm and group of people. So we, about 6 weeks or so before Royal Ascot, there was a race in Paris that he won, and Gary said, I think that's going to get him to Royal Ascot. And I said to Gary, oh, darling, sometimes we don't know the horse is running until that week. How can this be right? And he said, well, it's a little bit different over there. Anyway, I really didn't think that much more of it. And then, Newgate had a dinner to celebrate, and I thought, well, this is real. This horse is actually going to go and run at Royal Ascot. So, number one, just going there for the first time was the biggest, such a thrill in my life. Having a horse run in a race was incredibly exhilarating, exciting, but I've never, ever felt the thrill of seeing that horse run across that finishing line first. It was a joy like I cannot describe. I know I was making inhuman noises as he was running, going, I was saying, Mitchell. I think I was clinging on to Mitchell and going, and I said, it's going to win. And, just the celebrations afterwards, we tailgated into the evening, and the beautiful people. It was the fun being with other people and, and going into the winner's room at Royal Ascot. It was like, oh, my gosh, are we just actually standing in the winner's room? Camilla and Charles, it was a Prince Charles Cup, so Charles and Camilla presented the cup, and I was standing about, 2 metres away from them, because only one person could go up and receive the cup, and it wasn't me, damn it. But anyway, I was so close to them, and Princess Anne was standing next to me. And she's amazing because she was, walking around looking at our horse, and I said to Mitchell, I'm going to go up and tell her that we own that horse. And Mitchell said, Mum, be dignified, stand back. I said, damn it. I'm sure she would love a little bit of a chat because she knows her horses so well. So when she looks at horses, she knows what she's looking at. Anyway, so it was a massive thrill, a massive, massive thrill.
Well, we were living vicariously just seeing you at Royal Ascot, and we're saying, I don't know, was she there? The horse won. Can you believe this? And then there was the Royals, and we said, oh, this is just amazing.
It's incredible.
And we were so proud of you and everything you've achieved and your family and everybody who was up there. So we figure it couldn't have happened to a nicer horse. The horse was good too. But, Laurelly, it's not all beds of roses. I think you and I have shared another journey that neither of us expected, correct?
Correct, yes.
So do you want to share a little
bit
about that?
Yeah, sure. Well, I ran off my screening appointment for a breast screening appointment in November of 21. So I'd had a huge year that year with Forming Well Groomed and Dancing CEOs, and lots was going on. A lot was going on in that year. horses, everything, you know. And just raced off to my screening appointment. I had no symptoms. I had no lumps or something. I was just doing what I did every year. And they discovered that I had triple negative breast cancer. And it was quite aggressive. And it was just a shock. It hit me like a brick. I thought, this can't be happening. It's, you know, this is why I come every year for a screening. So, you know, they'll get it before it does anything. So, and it was just like all of a sudden in that very moment, everything changes. What was part of the rest of my year that I was planning was full of events and full of things. All of a sudden, nothing mattered except when I could get to see that doctor and when I was going to have my MRIs and all that. So, yeah, it all happened very quickly. So that was on a Wednesday. By the Friday, I was seeing the breast surgeon. I had to have my gallbladder out the next week, which had been scheduled, so I had to have that done. And then I had a mastectomy the week after. And I had to wait 3 weeks before I could start chemo. So then chemo started in January, and that went on for 4 months. 2 months after that, I had my other breast removed, which I decided to do just as a, you know, prevention. They told me that the chances were only marginally higher than anyone else to have to get breast cancer in that breast also, but it was a personal decision, and I decided to have that breast removed. And prior to that, I had also decided that I really needed to think about, you know, reconstruction and what that looked like. So I spoke to various doctors, and I went to an amazing plastic surgeon, so I decided on having implants. The expanders were fitted when I had the second mastectomy, so the two doctors worked together. So that was in the August, and then I just left that. I went back to the doctor every few weeks to have those pumped up till I, you know, got to the size that I was prior to breast cancer, and the temptation was always there to go bigger and better, but I thought, nope. I want my old bras to fit and I want my old clothes to fit. So I did that. And so it's been this journey. So it's, you know, sort of around, I guess, 21 months now or so. And is that right? Yes, it was, yeah. And it's now, you know, so the other thing that I didn't realise you could get done was you could have 3D nipples made. So
what was about that? I didn't know anything about that.
So I had that done 2 weeks ago, and that was amazing. That was so everything else. I don't only have that. Oh, sorry. Let me just go back to 2021. I also fell down a set of steps and cut open my leg 6 weeks before Dancing CEO. So that was the first time I'd ever had an anaesthetic ever in my life. I'd never broken anything, cut anything that was, you know, major cut or had an anaesthetic. So I had that. So I'd had all these, you know, GAs all through that year and then last year. And so when the option of the 3D nipples came up, I said to my plastic surgeon, well, I really don't want to have another general anaesthetic because I thought this has got to be building up in my body. So he said, no, it's a local, but he said, you know, you have to go through the whole hospital admission thing and, you know, you're in the operating theatre, but we can do it under a local, which was incredible. And it was just so easy. And now I have nipples.
I think you said to me, I'm just going to have this operation, but I'll see you in a couple of days. I'm thinking, or something like that you said, or see you at the end of the week. And I thought, what's she having now? I thought they were both gone. The boobs were gone. What's she having now? Maybe she's having I Love Gary kind of tattooed on her nipples or something like that.
I was going to have I Love Gary on one. I like Baz on another to give me options, but not.
Well, it is. We actually did have a little laugh this morning. I mean, we both can empathise that this journey is something that only really affects the individual. I mean, I don't think anyone can ever really know what you go through in that instant, that your life forever changes.
It does.
It never is the same again. No. And there are so many women that we know and so many women everywhere suffering from breast cancer.
There's so many women, Marissa.
And in many respects, it's good in a way that a lot of it's early detected, which, you know, we know there's a lot more success rates. I mean, imagine years ago when we didn't have the sophisticated technology to detect early.
Absolutely.
I mean, mine was early detection as well. But you always live now with the fear or the fact that, you know, it's forever changed your life and perhaps makes you more grateful in other ways as well. But we were sharing in a light moment some of the good things about having breast cancer. So you go first and I'm going to follow, and we should at least name two things from each of us that were some of the positive things about having breast cancer, only in a very comedic way, because not every moment was dark.
No, absolutely not. Can I just say first, generally, I feel that there's been specific silver linings, but the overwhelming thing that I'm so grateful for is that I feel healthier and happier than I ever have. And I feel like sometimes I did personally, even though I knew that I wanted to, get more sleep and eat better and do more exercise, I couldn't give myself permission to do it because I was so busy. And I felt like because I was so busy doing things like fundraising, I couldn't let people down. So I had to make it, I had to do it well, and I had to put a lot of time into it. And so the first thing that always happens when you're busy is that you let the things go, like going to your exercise classes and getting home, going for your walk, because you've got to get onto things and get them done. So breast cancer gave me the permission to focus on all those things that I knew that I had to do to get myself better. And all the science in the world is wonderful, but you need to change your life to do everything you possibly can. So again, eat the right foods, exercise. Exercise is such a major, major cause in prevention of recurrence. Anyway, that's being a bit serious, but
We do have some happy outcomes of having breast cancer, is what I meant, which that is one. Of course, you always understand, from my perspective, it was your friends and your family become the rocks upon which you base your recovery. I mean, there's just no denying that. It's just like people sometimes don't know how to react, but it doesn't matter what they do. My girlfriends, form the FOC Club, the Free of Cancer, of course that stands for. We all really know what it stands for. But, immediately Carla and Tracy formed hats, and we wore the FOCers hats, and we did the breast cancer walk, which you and I have done for the last two years for the MARTA, and used our experience as a precursor for our friends to join us and hopefully give us money as well. And we've raised probably about $40,000, I guess, for the MARTA Chicks and Team from that energy. So your energy has never kind of waned, even though you're focused on yourself. Name another thing that was probably a positive. If we had to find a positive message, we don't want to wish this upon anybody.
Yes.
But if you had to find a positive from having breast cancer, something that you learned that you didn't know before, name another one.
Oh, my goodness. I feel like there's just so many in my life. But I think one of the great things about going through something like that is the change in almost everything that touches your life. So, for example, taste buds. Your taste buds change. So you get to enjoy different food, different drinks, all these things that you never really liked before. They're divine. They're gorgeous.
Tell me one thing that you didn't like before.
Oh, gosh, I couldn't. Well, red wine. I'm very careful about alcohol intake these days. I feel like we've been talking about it a lot, but I'm very careful about the amounts. But nothing tastes better than that little glass of red wine of a nighttime with your meal. I never drank red wine before. It tasted awful. I hated it. But little things like that, just my food palate's changed. I actually love healthy food now, and I dislike anything that I don't feel is good going into my body. So it doesn't mean that I don't eat well. I eat incredibly well, but it's just such a lovely, wonderful thing to be able to, discover all these new bits and pieces. And just, my family have been my complete rock. My friends have been too. And I think the clarity of good friendship is so beautiful, and it's something that, even though I always knew about that and I always appreciated my friends, I have such clarity now that I don't waste time with people who I don't need to be with, and I find that very cleansing for many reasons, and it's beautiful to be able to devote your time. I used to say I don't have time to devote to the people I really love. This person's, really making things difficult for me. I just don't let them anymore. So that's been such a silver lining. And I really don't think, had I not had breast cancer, that I would have ever have discovered that. I think I was too set in a way of thinking I've got a million friends and I need to tend to them all, and if they're causing me problems, I just need to deal with that. And and now it's just such a lovely, really lovely feeling just to know that every time, all my time is spent with really good people. And I love that.
I love that message as well. And I'm on a little bit of a humorous end. I think one of the things I quite liked was not spending any more money on waxing or hairdressing for a while whilst you undertook chemotherapy and radiation.
I know.
I was petrified about losing my hair because I have a lumpy head. So I knew that I would never – I used to say when I was younger, I hope I never get breast cancer because I'm not going to be able to be bald. So I never showed my bald head ever. I remember you rocked your bald head and you rocked a scarf. But – one test of that was that I had wigs in every length, basically. And I remember going to North Queensland to visit my husband's family once. And in the morning I wore my little kind of, Maxwell Smart's agent, what's it, G99?
Yes.
Really short, blunt hair cut. And then in the evening I wore what was more like my hair, which was a longer shoulder length blonde hair, a wig. And we'd round the dinner table and Philip's mother, Mary, who's hilarious, just said, through all this treatment, through chemo and radiation, it's amazing you haven't lost your hair. I'd had these two different haircuts. I mean, most people didn't know on social media I was going through cancer. I didn't share that journey with very many people because I tried to just live a normal life. But I thought to myself, you know what? The one thing I was worried about losing my hair was the one thing she had no idea of. So she obviously – I thought it would actually define you, your hair would define you. But in that moment I knew that, the hair is just an accessory.
Yeah,
and
it is.
I said, actually, I've been wearing wigs all day. Really? She said to me.
That's gorgeous.
Then I did actually whip it off in the middle of dinner and that scared everybody to billy. And I think they actually told me to put it straight back on because my scalp was very bad. But I think that's the other thing on a more comic note.
Yes.
No hairdressing appointments. Despite my hairdresser being in my life for 36 years, I did still have to visit him once a month just to say hello. One thing I think we loved doing was forming the Badass Breasties in your honour, Laurelie, and I remember ringing you because we wanted to do the martyr walk. It was only a few months after you'd been diagnosed. We wanted to do the walk and wanted to do it in your honour. And beautiful Sophia from our office termed the word, we were racking our brains for quite a while, weren't we, team, about forming something. Badass Breasties was so you. No one's more badass than you. And I remember ringing you to see if this was something that we could do because we weren't sure you'd be participating. Well, you were the first to sign up and get, yes, I desperately want to do this. And we were so excited by the fact that, you could have just sat back. And, of course, you rallied your troops and we made a fortune for Mother Chicks
and Pink.
And we were so proud of doing it for you and with you. And I think that was not the first time that you and I had been engaged in philanthropy in a big way. Of course, the Dancing CEOs was one of the pinnacle achievements of your life, wasn't it?
Oh, that was amazing. That was amazing. And, again, it was the universe because I had always thought, having, three teenage sons and a daughter, and I had seen with the difference in ages of my children, a very increase in mental health for young boys, and I really wanted to do something about that. And I was really, it was on my mind. I was trying to work out what I could do to really make a difference. And then, God bless you, Marissa, you put my name forward. I know you did.
I
got a call from Women's Legal Service. And I remember going to meet with them. And I said, look, I really would love to do this, but I really feel like I need to devote my time to mental health. And I went home and I started thinking about it. And I thought, I've always thought that so much domestic violence is caused by men with mental health issues. And I thought, I'll do this. I'll do it once and I'll raise a whole lot of money and then that will allow me to move on into fundraising for mental health. And, well, that didn't happen. Of course, I've got breast cancer. And so I feel like it's something that I was meant to do because it – and I still believe that, and I still think of ways that I will move further into doing work for mental health, particularly adolescent mental health. But right now, every time I read of another woman dying at the hands of a violent person, I feel like my work's not done, and I want to keep helping and keep making sure that there is an avenue there for these women who are terrified of leaving a volatile situation, and the security and the love and the care that Women's Legal Service gives those women through legal advice and social welfare and just general humanity is amazing. So, yeah, it's going to be hard. I think I'm just going to split my time between horses, domestic violence and mental health and make it all work together.
Well, don't forget breast cancer.
And breast cancer, sorry. Sorry.
You're the epitome of ask a busy woman.
Darling, right? Breast cancer is always going to, you know, that's of course is always going to be close to my heart. So, yeah.
No, and, yeah. And you made a spectacular, if anyone wants to check it out on YouTube, Lauralee Cunningham, Dancing CEOs, you'll see her unraveled in this sheet, and it's just the most spectacular because there's choreography in the family, yes. Of course. So it was obviously never going to be a dull and boring dance performance at City Hall. It was nothing but you were the highest fundraiser ever. At that point in time, I think you were the benchmark against which others plot themselves. Yeah. So, yeah, and we are both very much proud ambassadors now for Women's Legal Service. So, Lauralee, now that we've both done Dancing CEOs once, would you consider doing it again?
Yes. Yes. Look, I think I would. I always thought after the first time I wouldn't because I knew just what a huge commitment it is. And I had promised my family that I was going to after, breast cancer, that was going to quieten down a little bit. But I still would love, yes, I think I absolutely would do it again.
So I have a thought. I mean, next year marks 40 years since Women's Legal Service Queensland started its operations, and you and I couldn't even count the number of women and children that have benefited from that service.
That's
and
right.
We've seen firsthand what offering they make. And did you know that next year it's 10 years since the Dancing CEOs campaign for?
Is it 10 years?
10 years.
There you go.
10 years, and I think we worked out there's over $3 million that's been raised for Women's Legal Service from wonderful people like you getting up and dancing and raising money. And so I've heard a rumour that they are doing an All-Stars next year.
Really? Goodness me.
Do you think you might consider coming back as an All-Star if I consider coming back as an All-Star?
Absolutely. That wasn't hard, was it?
But I have to compete against you, unless.
But we can't do that.
Unless we did it together.
I'll stop it.
But can would I have to do country?
Absolutely. That is the only prereq I've got. As long as you can do some boot scoot and country with me.
Well, this may be a whole new educational experience
but
for
yes,
me.
Yes, why don't we do it?
I mean, All-Stars team?
Yes.
I think we can do this.
I think we do. And you know what? We have such amazing common networks that if we pool both of our resources together, can you imagine how much money we can raise?
Well, let's face it. They're not going to know who to support. We're going to have Lauralee supporters, Marissa supporters and Switzerland supporters
exactly.
in the middle.
Exactly. And so it's just too confusing.
And Team Lauralee.
Oh, my goodness.
Team Lauralee, Marissa, and with a sexy name we'll have to come up with.
Oh, this is amazing. I think this is the best idea you've ever had.
Watch out, Dancing CEOs. We are on the dance floor. We are hitting the dance floor, Lauralee. We've made a pledge. Now everyone knows about it. Obviously on the podcast. We have to commit to it.
It's done, isn't it?
Done.
There you go. Okay.
Done.
High five. There we go. Doing it.
So
how exciting.
Oh my goodness. What am I getting myself into?
Oh, a whole lot of work and a whole lot of fun.
A whole lot of fun. There's absolutely every guarantee there'll be fun. Lauralee, it's just been – I've got two quick questions to finish off this podcast, something and we always ask everybody, my goodness, has my team just taken that down? We are doing this for 2024. You better go home and break the news to your family.
I know. I'll do it gently, very gently.
And those other competitors out there and other people you get your skates on to because
yes.
I think next year could be the biggest year ever for Dancing CEOs.
Oh, it will
and
be.
Women's Legal Service. Lauralee, what do you want to be when you grow up?
Oh, goodness. You know, I know this is a very odd answer, but I actually feel like I have grown up. And I felt like I'm going to start crying now. I really felt like I had breast cancer. Oh, goodness, I need to stop. It made me grow up, and I feel very happy that I've become – oh, goodness, I can barely speak. I feel like I've become the person I've always wanted to be. So – is that okay to say that?
I think it's very okay. Making me cry. I imagine you've always been this kind of person, and perhaps it just gives us permission to express it.
Yeah.
I think that's probably, there's exactly. a lot of things that people don't say. And I think sometimes when a pivotal moment hits, you do get permission to say what you think. So we feel very privileged that we've shared that with you.
Thank you.
Well, then I guess the next question is a natural one about what makes you happy.
Oh, my children, my babies, my family, my husband, children, babies, and I've got 10 little grandchildren, and the joy and the love that they give me, and, you know, they were there with me when I was not well, and those little darling angels, they're gentle. They knew that they couldn't jump on Lola because, you know, Lola just had surgery or Lola was going through chemo. But the love at all their different ages that they in their own way gave to me. So my happiness is them. My happiness is my children and my husband. I am so lucky. I'm so – and not a day goes by that I'm not grateful. So that's what makes me happy. Can I add my friends and beautiful people like you too?
Oh, well, we would be privileged to be in your orbit. And so thank you so much for joining us today. I have had such a good time. I've learned so much about you that I never knew. But I was just thinking back to Light Up the Room, your first course. Is that right?
That's right.
I think, Lauralee, you light up the universe. And it's just a beautiful – and maybe that should be the name of the next course. Can you tell Gary that from me? That I'm perhaps lighting up the universe. Or at least lighting up the dance floor is definitely on the agenda.
That's what we have to do, darling.
Yeah. It's been such a privilege to interview you today. Thank you for sharing our space with us, Lauralee, and I can't wait for the next few months.
Marissa, thank you for being in my life and thank you for today. You are amazing and I just loved every second talking to you. Thank you.
What a conversation. Laughter, tears, and some profound moments that touched our hearts. Now that the cat's out of the bag, Marissa and Lauralee teaming up for Dancing CEOs All-Stars in 2024. You're probably wondering, how can I contribute to this extraordinary venture? Keep your eyes peeled for fundraising events coming up this year at Hanworth House and others hosted by Lauralee as well. You will see the usual events you know and love each year, including Labels on the Lawn, as well as some brand new events you won't want to miss. Make sure you're on our exclusive mailing list at Hanworth House so you don't miss a single update or invitation. Trust us, you won't want to miss out on these incredible experiences. And here's your chance to make a difference that truly matters. Consider making a donation to Women's Legal Service Queensland for the Dancing CEOs campaign. Not only will you be supporting an incredible cause, but you'll also snag a tax-deductible receipt before the end of financial year. It's a win-win. Simply visit the link in the episode description to make your contribution. Every little bit counts. And as usual, if you liked this episode, please rate, review, and subscribe. And if you have any questions, you can email them through to podcast@hanworthhouse.com.au. That's HANWORTH. Thanks for joining us again on Bubbles and Benevolence, and we'll be back soon with another special guest.
Cheers.
Cheers.